You've had three near-death experiences, like legit near-death experiences.
Which leads us to why ClickUp even exists today, because I'm obsessed with productivity and efficiency and how you get more done with the very, very, very limited time that we have.
Zeb Evans, the co-founder and CEO of ClickUp, a productivity software startup that he built from nothing into a $4 billion company in under 5 years.
I think you have this imposter syndrome. Am I even supposed to be here? I don't know what I'm doing. But the reality is, everyone doesn't know what they're doing. Everybody's just figuring out as you go.
What do you think were the key habits that you attribute most of your success to?
Discipline and hard work. 5 a.m. stand-ups, 7 days a week, and you're working out every day. And I don't see any great companies that were built from work-life balance.
In what ways have you had to adapt and evolve to be where you're at today?
Grow 1% every day, and that compounds over time, and you become a 10x person. So I think it's really important to consume the right things at the time that you're doing them. There's too many people that consume and they don't do.
What was the lowest low, darkest moment? What is up, guys? Welcome back to the World Class Podcast. Today, I sit down with my good friend, Zeb Evans, the co-founder and CEO of ClickUp, a productivity software startup that he built from nothing into a $4 billion company in under 5 years. And in this conversation, we talk about exactly how Zeb went from three near-death experiences to building one of the fastest growing software companies in the world. We talk about his habits and his rituals that led to his success and his spiritual journey in finding fulfillment along the way. So without further ado, let's dive in. So Zeb, this is a special episode because of our context. I'll give the audience some context on how we met. 2020, January, 4.5 years ago, I met you. You were, I think, 15, 20 people in a small office in San Diego. You were my first client when I launched Quantum, my recruiting business, the first guy who gave me a shot. And I think about two years later, we had placed about 50 people with you guys. You were a $4 billion company, one of the fastest growth companies in SaaS in history. And I got to see you go from this scrappy early stage founder, just figuring shit out, to a legit leader and CEO of a $4 billion company. Still just figuring shit out, but it's been an amazing ride. And so I'm just, I think it was one of the most fulfilling parts of my life and my professional career was working with you. So I'm just excited to share your story with the world.
It's been an amazing journey. And so much of life is timing. And the timing we had was impeccable in meeting each other because you've helped us out tremendously as we've scaled. And that was that pivotal piece of our journey where we were in that true hypergrowth stage where it was all about hiring people and building as fast as you can. And we weren't perfect. We made a lot of mistakes during that. Maybe we'll get into some of those today, but it's been an awesome journey.
I agree. I want to dive into ClickUp, how you built it, because you guys did some amazing things. Before we do that, I'd love to give some context on your history because I think that really paints the picture for who you are today. You've had three near-death experiences, like legit near-death experiences. The first one was when you were 10. Can you share what happened when you were 10 and how did that become the catalyst for your career as an entrepreneur?
I was in a boating accident, really bad accident. I was in the hospital for 2 months and I couldn't eat during pretty much the whole time. I couldn't eat. And so I couldn't watch TV either because at the time, I mean, this was 24 years ago, you're watching cable TV and you're switching through channels and there's commercials and there was every fucking commercial was like McDonald's or some food brand. And so I couldn't watch TV because it just kept reminding me of food. And they had a laptop in the before that, this period, I had not really been exposed to technology. Again, this is 25 years ago and very small town in North Carolina. You don't really have access to technology like you do today. But they had a laptop in the hospital and I started using it there and I really became obsessed with technology. Prior to that, I was always obsessed with being an entrepreneur. I was that kid that was asking at 3 years old for toys, wholesale toys that I could sell to other kids for my birthdays and Christmas gifts instead of toys for, I don't ever actually remember asking for like a gift for myself. It was always something to sell to other kids.
That's incredible. So you started playing on a computer. Was that when you built your first website or what were you doing on the computer there?
Yeah, I think I used this GoDaddy WYSIWYG editor for the first time. And I found Alibaba. I think Alibaba had just come out. And I started buying wholesale like DVDs through Alibaba and a few other random websites that I found. And at the time, Disney did this marketing tactic for their DVDs, where it was called the Disney Vault. And it essentially decreased supply and the demand was there. They just kind of like retired DVDs every now and then. And so what did that do? It jacked the prices up of many Disney DVDs, like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs was like $100.
No way.
So I get the arbitrage there. I could buy it for like $10 wholesale and sell it for $100 on eBay. And that was one of my first hustles.
So that was your first business, was an eBay DVD arbitrage.
Yeah.
That's incredible. So fast forward, you got your first taste of being an entrepreneur at 10 years old. What was your second near-death experience? At what age was that?
It was when I was 20 and I was robbed at gunpoint in a home invasion. And I had this, I think people always talk about these like out-of-body experiences when you have near-death experiences. I haven't had that, but I had this thing where I was like just thinking towards, I was in college for context. I went to Virginia Tech for 2 years and I just had this thing where I was just like, you know, I'm wasting my time right now. And I was like, if I am fortunate enough to live through this, I'm not going to ever waste time again. And that was what I really carried with me from that second near death experience. It was all about time, which leads us to why ClickUp even exists today, because I'm still very much obsessed with productivity and efficiency and how you get more done with the very, very, very limited time that we have.
That's profound. So your near-death experiences really left you with this idea that we don't have a lot of time. So how do I make the most of my time, right? And how do I eliminate unnecessary things or make things less frictionless or more frictionless so that I can allocate my time units to the things that I actually care about and live a meaningful life?
Exactly.
It's incredible. So that was your second one. And then the third one comes a bit later, but we'll dive into that in a sec. But you met Chris Cunningham at Virginia Tech, who ended up being one of the early team members at ClickUp. It was you, Alex Jurkowski, your CTO, Chris Cunningham, and Wes Burmett. Mm-hmm. Early days, you weren't working on ClickUp at first, though.
Right.
So talk to me about what were you working on at the time with those guys? You're in Silicon Valley. What were you working on and how did ClickUp come to be?
Well, for a little more context, my first, I would say, real business was social media marketing. And we did automation and basically increasing people's followers and engagement on social media. And that was something that, I mean, it kind of brings us to our third near-death experience is how this transition works, is that I had the third near-death experience. So I had a seizure. And this one, obviously, seizures don't last that long, but the impact of this was that I actually thought that I had a tumor for like a week, because seizures are pretty much always epilepsy or it's like something neurologically bad.
Yeah.
And my dad had a really bad brain tumor growing up and I got tested for epilepsy like the next day. I didn't have that. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of self-diagnosed myself with, I'm like, fuck, here's another one, you know, another thing.
Yeah.
But through that period was really important because I learned that that was my third lesson, was like net positive. Everything should be net positive. Everything that you spend time on, everything that you spend money on, all of the relationships that you have in your life, like everything should be net positive. And I think that that previous business may not have been net positive, like for the world.
Just like growing social media followers.
Yeah.
It helped people, but it wasn't really impactful.
I mean, you see what happens, you know, and of course I'm not like the anti-tech person. Like I am certainly a very like free market person at heart. So it's nothing against like the social media companies. It's more on like the consumer, and the consumer is really addicted to a lot of this ego on social media that happens. And that was a lesson that we learned when I wanted to create a new social media app, and we did. And that was to answer your question. That was the first thing that we worked on. It was called Memory, M-I-M-R-I. And the whole premise was capturing your memories in your life without ego. So it didn't have, you did have followers, but nobody else knew how many followers you had, right? You couldn't see numbers. You couldn't see numbers of everyone else's engagement. And that didn't work. People didn't want that.
It was a noble intention, but you realize the consumer wasn't going to stick with it.
Yeah, but it was really a great lesson in many ways. Also because it was our first kind of like legit like tech platform that we were building. And so we made a lot of wrong technical decisions and we learned from those. And I actually don't think ClickUp would have been successful without doing that memory app. And that was one that we failed fast. You know, I think we worked on it like 3-4 months, marketed it for another like 2 months. And then I was like, fuck this. Like, let's go.
We're out of here.
Let's go.
After that, I think you tried to start like a Craigslist competitor or something like that. Right? What was that?
Yeah. So the next thing was I always used Craigslist my whole life, you know, entrepreneur buying and selling shit. Yeah. And, but it was always so, it's, first of all, it's a terrible user experience. It's like the worst user experience product in the world, at least from a UI perspective.
Absolutely.
Right. Maybe it's super simple to use and stuff, but it's an absolutely terrible design. And so maybe that was a little bit too harsh, but like, I just always been very like, why don't they make it better?
Right.
And it's also just sketchy because, you know, there's no payments in an app, there's no ratings, there's no review system. And I thought that that was a really big problem to solve. And I think at the time it was, at least internally, without credit card fraud, it was the largest source of fraud in the United States was through Craigslist. And I really wanted to create a new great experience where people could buy and sell things online and in person. So we were going to build that. But before we started building that, we wanted to build on top of a very flexible project management application. And those just didn't exist at the time. Everything was super rigid and opinionated and how you have to work. So we built our own. And the first thing was just, again, at the time, you could not switch between a list view and a board view in project management. You had Trello for boards and you had Asana for lists. And you literally could not switch between the two. I was like, this is the same data model. Why can't we just visualize it differently? And so that's what we built. That was our first thing that we built. And we just used it for ourselves. And we planned on building it only for ourselves at first. But after like 3 or 4 weeks, it didn't take us a long time. It was like a few weeks to build this. And immediately I was like, all right, this is what we're focusing on.
This is what we're focusing on.
This is what we're doing.
I love how you accidentally built ClickUp. I feel like a lot of the best companies come from building internal tools that benefit you. And you're like, oh shit, there's a there.
100%. I think you have to solve your own problems in business. If you don't solve your own problems, it's very rare that I see great businesses that aren't built by somebody solving their own problem.
Yeah, that's a great point. How did you get your early traction? Like, how did you get your first 100 or so customers? What were the keys?
I did all of that organic hacky marketing shit myself. And so I literally would go on. One of the things we did was Capterra and G2 Crowd have reviews on them. And so I would go look at anybody posting a negative review at our competitors. And I would try and match their name in LinkedIn. And then I would send them a message and say, hey, we've got this solution to your problem. And that was like one of the little things that I did. And we kind of tried to scale that. Of course, that doesn't scale.
Yeah.
But we did SEO. And, you know, SEO is one of those things that still nowadays, and it's, you know, very blurry to me what the future of SEO is going to be. Probably more AI first. And I think we'll be paid within AI. So instead of paid placement in search today, I think you'll have paid placement in AI also, similar to how we do that today when we pay for it. But when I was doing it, we had no money. So we had to just write blogs, and we would write competitor blogs, Asana versus ClickUp, you know, what's Asana alternatives. And that was how we started getting our very early customers.
That's incredible. I think Brian Chesky has something he says is early on, do things that don't scale. Right. And you did that. You're like guerrilla marketing. How do I get my first couple hundred users? Positioning yourself against the competitors, writing thoughtful blogs. Like, that's the stuff that people don't get. Like, it doesn't scale at first, but that's incredible. You got some more traction. At this point, you're in the most competitive space. I mean, productivity space is very crowded. You've got Asana, you've got Monday, you got Trello, you got Miro, Notion. I mean, there's so many companies, and the VCs weren't the biggest fans at first. Right? Like, you're trying to boil the ocean. How are you going to build all this in one app? Like, pick a lane. They didn't really buy into it at first. What was the experience for you like raising capital? And then how did you eventually convince them to give you money?
It was really frustrating. I actually never wanted to raise capital in the early years. And so we didn't even consider it. We got reached out to by a lot of VCs, but we didn't even consider it. And then when we became cash flow positive, I started worrying about our competition because they were raising hundreds of millions of dollars.
A lot of money.
And so, you know, I mean, it's like at the end of the day, I think, could we have scaled as fast without that money? Absolutely not. I don't think there's any way. So I do buy, you know, the principle that like raising money can certainly give you a leapfrog and a big moat against competition. And so we weren't going to sit on the sidelines and, you know, let everybody eat our lunch.
Pass by you.
So I started saying yes to meetings, and I went up, I think it was October 2019. I went up to SF and I just stacked a shit ton of meetings, like 40 or 50 meetings in a week. And I went to all of them super confident because, you know, everybody was this at this point, we were a relatively good investment for a VC. We were cash flow positive. Yeah. We were growing 30-40% month over month. So it was a good bet for VCs. At least that's what I thought. And that's what they told me too. But I get to the end of this week and I have no term sheets. And I'm like following up with investors, you know, and I'm like, hey, are you guys going to give us a term sheet or not? And nobody said no. And I stayed up there another week. I actually stayed up there 2 more weeks, I think. And I kept doing some, they would say, hey, you know, let's do another meeting. I want you to talk to this person. Let's look at some of the metrics. You know, let me talk to somebody on your team. And I kept doing that. And by the end of the 3 weeks, I was like, is nobody going to give me a term sheet? I was like, this is a waste of fucking time. And so I left and I like stopped talking. I was pissed off, you know, and I was like, all right, I'm going to go do this myself.
Yeah. And you wrote that in your journal too.
Yeah.
You're like, screw the VCs. I'll do it myself.
You got to do what you got to do. And so I went back down to San Diego and I just rallied the team and I was like, we're going to do this ourselves. And that moment of like inspiration, like the fortitude piece of it uh-huh. is what I really try. That's one of the word that I love, courage through adversity, fortitude. That's what I try to preach to our teams every day. And that's what we look for when we're hiring people. But as far as VCs go, I mean, yeah, we didn't get a deal. And so I saw it as a waste of time and I stopped talking to them until
David Sachs.
Yeah. So this was summer of 2020 in the middle of COVID.
Yep.
And Kraft reached out and I think Brian from Kraft reached out.
Brian Rosenblatt, yeah.
And we talked and then he was like, I think Sachs would really enjoy talking with you. And I talked to Sachs for what felt like a really long time. I went way longer than I thought it was going to, but we really connected. And I saw that on the other side of that VC is a builder. Right, somebody that's been through it before.
Yeah.
And it was almost like this sense of trust. But it's just, we're same wavelength. You know how when you meet people and your gut, your instincts just tell you, okay, this is the right thing.
Yeah.
That was the first time that happened with a VC for me.
You mentioned that's important too, because there's a lot of VCs with huge brand names, but at the end of the day, you got to choose the person you have a gut instinct. You're like, I want to build with this person. Like I trust this person.
Yeah. And being aligned with your values.
Yes. Right?
And the way you see the world too,
yeah.
I think is sometimes important.
That was critical. And before we had got to San Diego and raised capital, I think an important thing to point out too is what it took to get you to San Diego. The first few years in Silicon Valley, you're in the house in Palo Alto. It's you, Chris, Alex, and Wes. Talk about the level of work ethic and the culture that you built early on. Because it's people need to pay attention to this. People think it's just easy building a tech company, but the level of discipline and work ethic you guys deployed, because you lacked experience. The whole team was not very experienced, but you guys had insane hunger. You're super smart. Talk to us about like what that house was like and what the first few years were like.
Yeah, I don't know if this was even legal, but like I was definitely more of like a general. And I was like, look, here's the rules. We're doing a year of no drinking, no girls, 5 a.m. stand-ups every single day, including Saturday and Sunday.
7 days a week.
7 days a week, 5 a.m. And you're working out every day. And so those were like the principles that we lived by. And we did book reports every week where we each read one book and then we would report on it to each other. So we could kind of have a shared knowledge of 4 or 5 books that we were reading at the same time. Many of them are sitting behind you right now. And that gave us that growth that we didn't really have that experience, you know, so you can go read from other people and learn a lot.
Yes.
Don't necessarily follow everything, but you learn all that context and you can make it applicable to where you are today. Mm-hmm. And we had the ultimate discipline. And I think that discipline and that hard work is really critical. And I think people don't talk about it as much anymore. It's always work-life balance. And I don't see any great companies that were built from work-life balance.
You see the Jensen Huang quote that just went viral from NVIDIA, right? He's like, I wish upon you suffering because to be great requires character and you can't get a character from a degree. You have to earn character through suffering and overcoming adversity.
You've got to go through hard shit. And that's the single biggest question that I care about when I ask leaders. I ask them, what's the hardest thing when I'm hiring people? What's the hardest thing that you've ever done or been through? And usually they answer in the work context. And then I ask, what's the hardest thing you've ever done outside of work or been through outside of work? And if you'll get a fast answer from people that have been through something, and from people that haven't, you know, it's very wishy-washy. And I definitely lean way more towards the people that have been through hard shit, because building a company is really tough, like really, really, really tough. And you have to like keep that steady state of mind as you're going through really hard shit. And I think it's much easier to do that if you've been through hard things in the past.
That's a great point. Speaking to that, it's hard to build a team where people share that, right? I think especially when you're up against these Goliaths like you guys were, and it was cool to actually be in the front lines with you early on, because you had an insane hiring bar and you didn't have a lot of capital to pay for these guys either. So you needed to find the best talent that would take a fraction of what they normally could get, that was truly bought in the mission. And you were one of the best in the world I've ever seen at just like enrolling people in your vision, but getting the right type of people on early. What kind of personality traits, what kind of people were you focused on hiring, especially in the early days of ClickUp?
Still today, it's the same. I like unproven people that want to work hard and that really care. And I think caring is something that goes, like, honestly, if you look around at people you work with, generally, especially at large companies, there's not a lot of people that care that much that I've seen. And I like working with people that really care and that are passionate about what we're doing. And that is a really high bar, to find that stuff with competence, right? To find somebody that also has some experience. But I think that's why I say unproven people also, because a lot of the proven people just aren't like that as much anymore. Nothing against them, but people that are very experienced, very proven, have made it on the other side and seen what it looks like. They don't necessarily want to go through that journey again.
Right.
So I like finding the people that want to go on that journey.
I like that. And I've learned that through the biggest mistakes I've made in hiring executives is having shiny logos and great career histories, but they lost the fire. And my number one thing is, and you could have done this before, but still have it. It just depends. But hire people with chips on their shoulder, like either that have something to prove to themselves, to the bully from 10th grade, to the world, whatever it is, but they got to have something to prove. Because then you're wrapped up in an identity that says, I can't lose. I have to win at all costs. And when you find that energy, like I would bet on that person all day versus the smart person who doesn't have that fuel, because emotions ultimately fuel us, right? Without emotional reasons and big whys, there's no reason to persist through all the bullshit you have to face, because you guys have gone through some insanely turbulent times as any hypergrowth company does. And so, but as you scale and get bigger too, as you guys are going through it, I know you guys started hiring some more big execs, and you had to go through your process of discovering what works even at scale. What did you discover as you grew the company in terms of best hiring practices? Because you can't hire the same people as when you were 10, but what did you discover?
A lot of things, but I think a few really important lessons. And one of mm-hmm. those was, if you have a product-led founder, mm-hmm. you shouldn't have a head of product. If you have a tech-led founder, you shouldn't have a head of engineering that isn't that tech-led founder. And that's something that, I mean, our VCs, but also myself, I thought I needed to go hire somebody with experience, right? Somebody that has done this before and somebody that scaled a large organization to lead product. And I tried it 3 times and it doesn't work out. And finally realized that, hey, I am head of product. And I think that's the way to run things when you're a product-led founder. And I love spending most of my time on product. So it's a win-win for me also. I'm much happier when I spend time in product. And we went through that lesson in several areas of the business, hiring for pedigree and experience and background, rather than looking from within first, but also looking at those culture traits that we discussed that I care much more about than the pedigree and the experience piece of it.
I noticed too, instead of hiring some of the bigger brand name execs, you started acquiring companies and hiring CEOs to run divisions for you. That was also probably a smart move, because now your executives are actual entrepreneurs.
My favorite strategy.
Your favorite strategy.
It's my favorite strategy. That's how you get 10X engineers. And I think it's really hard to find 10X engineers at big companies, even at scaling companies up. Yep. I think startups have 10X engineers. They're the highest, I think, ratio of engineers would be in startups. And so we look for really small teams that are 2 to 8 or 9 people that have built something in a short period of time That's impressive, right? Something, and we look also a lot for front end products, more heavy on the front end, because we have a very, very front end heavy web application.
Delightful user experience, super complex. Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard to find people that have seen a lot on the front end side, especially in management and leadership.
Oh,
almost
yeah.
all like engineering leaders are back end engineers. And that was where we made a huge mistake.
Yeah.
Is all of our engineering management was back end. And I'll never forget, I'm at an engineering management meeting. And I realized this before. And so I was at the meeting at all hands, just for the leadership. And I was like, raise your hand if you consider yourself more front end than back end. Nobody raised their hand.
You're like, oh shit.
And I thought we were going to get like a couple. You know? Nobody raised their hand. And I was like, okay.
Yeah.
We lost a good year or so of velocity and development by making some of those mistakes.
Yeah. That's incredible. Because I was going to say the thing I think you did best. I mean, I think you hit product market fit twice as fast as any competitor or close to it. Your guys' metrics and unit economics were astounding, like best in market. But I think a lot of that's contributed to how fast you guys moved. And I like what you pointed out. You had small teams, so you didn't want to overpopulate the kitchen. You had small teams. And you were shipping, I don't know what rate of features
every
you were
week.
Shipping. Every week you every were shipping week. A robust feature.
Yeah.
Right? What was the
not bullshit.
Yeah, like not bullshit. Like what was your secret to running really tight-knit teams and iterating and having really strong product velocity?
Well, everybody talks about shipping. You know, the latest thing is shipping every hour, right? But we shipped every week. And so now it doesn't sound as impressive. But when you ship the every hour, you're not, you know, you're shipping patches. You're shipping very small things. We were actually delivering real tangible features, like big features and improvements to the platform every single week. So it wasn't just a bullshit check the box shipping with bug fixes and patches. It was very much like, let's take a leap forward in what we have as far as capabilities go for our product. And that was something that I actually don't even remember where that came from, honestly, but it kind of just, I think we just tried shipping every Friday for a few, and then it felt like, hey, why not just do this every Friday?
Yeah.
And that's what we did. And we lost it for about a year, that year period that I was talking about. We're back to it now though. We're back to
You're
it.
You're back to
we're
it.
We're back better than ever.
Why did you lose it for that year? Just got too big and it was hard to maintain that, or?
It was for a variety of reasons. It was hiring the wrong leadership, focusing way more on back end than front end.
Yep.
And we definitely scaled too fast. And if you add, you know, if you have 5 to 10 engineers that have all of the context in the code base, and then you add 100, 200 engineers, those 5 to 10 engineers, all of their time is spent like helping people get onboarded. Mm. And nobody else has context of the whole code base. So we hired definitely a little bit too quickly on the engineering side, to where everybody was just figuring out things as they go. Mm. And it takes a long time to gain context of a code base, especially one that you built in a move fast, break things manner.
There was that period in 2021 when every company was in hyper growth. It was growth at all costs. No one's focusing the bottom line. I think you got up to what, over 1,000 employees?
Yep.
That's remarkable. I guess in 2020 hindsight, you've had a lot of fuck ups. You've had a lot of big wins, but you've had a lot of fuck ups like we all do. If you look back outside of hiring alone, can you think of any other big mistakes that you made that if you could go back, you would have done things differently?
For me, that question's always really tough, because if you go back and fix something, you would have run into a different thing.
It's a butterfly effect, right?
You know, it's a butterfly effect. Yeah. Like there's always something else that may not have happened had we not gone through those learnings.
And you got the learnings from that. So it wasn't necessarily regret.
You got the learnings from it. Even that year of velocity really slowing down, we got amazing learnings from it, that mistakes that we'll never make again.
Yeah.
And we're much better now than we ever were as far as an engineering and product velocity and product goes in general. And so I don't think, we may not have gotten to this point had I not gone through that year and then been hyper focused on like, what were the problems during that period? And how do I tactically go and fix every one of them? Mm. And I think I could take that and apply it for many things.
Yeah.
But you know, we definitely got, it's all about timing. Like I said, and when we raised our Series C, it was great timing. I knew that there was going to be some market event that happened. And I got asked a lot, why are you raising $400 million? And I was like, well, because there's going to be a market event that happens sometimes in the future. And it's a good, damn good time to raise right now. And so we got out right at the peak time.
Raised up what, $535 million roughly in total?
Yep.
That was, I'm curious though, because you, at first you couldn't compete with the big guys. You didn't have funding. Then you raised over $500 million and you're competing with the companies that had a big run ahead of you, the Asanas, the Trellos, the Mondays. Like, how did you guys differentiate? How did you cut through such a crowded space and actually become a dominant player? Like, what would you attribute that success to? The core.
I'm not a huge fan of the term last mover because there's you never know when the last mover. It's like, it's last mover is more like most recent mover,
right?
You know,
right.
It's more of like the person that
like
the
Apple
newcomer
with the
to
iPhone.
The space.
Like Apple was later in the iPhone in the phone market, but just dominated.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And so we learned a lot of the things that I from using all of these products. I learned so much of how what I would do differently. And a lot of it was about flexibility. It was removing a lot of the rigidness of these products. And this was before no code tools. Right. So that was our first product really was just being able, it was the first time you could view your tasks in a different way. You could view them in a calendar, in a list, in a board, all at the same time. And with our second version of our product, this was more of like a leap forward towards the vision of putting everything in one place. And we added things like whiteboards and we added time tracking and we added docs. We added a variety of products that were usually very separate, unbundled products at the time. And it's the way the industry headed. And with 3.0, which we released about a year ago, we added much more collaboration focused where you can really work on anything together in one place. And we're releasing the next version of our product very soon, which really is the first time where I'll feel like, okay, this is the original vision that I had 6 years ago. This is it. And I'm really excited about it.
Because you're a compound startup, right? You're building many apps in one, removing the friction so you can have all your work in one place. Rippling's doing the same thing. I don't think people understand how hard that is to pull off.
Very difficult.
Ridiculously hard. It's like building seven companies at the same time.
It's very difficult.
And I got to give you credit because you actually gave me the vision for Quantum. I started working with you and we were doing a lot of work across all levels. And I was like,
I don't think you gave me any equity.
Yeah, you did give me some equity, right? Yeah.
Did you give me equity?
We should probably talk after.
Yeah.
Probably get you on the board here. But it's so funny because the VCs laughed you at the room at first, right?
Yeah.
They're like, this is too much. Like pick a lane, whatever. It's already competitive space. Same thing with me when I pitched this vision. But I said, well, why don't we apply what ClickUp's doing to recruiting and actually be able to take companies from seed through IPO, have partners over every different division, every skill set from every stage in the company's life cycle, and run them as separate companies, an executive company and a scaling company. But build them in parallel so we can cross-functionally build entire companies. And no one had commercialized that before. And we're still on our path to like becoming, a massive company like you guys. But that gave me the seed for that model, and I owe you a lot of credit for that.
You can move it's definitely harder, as you pointed out, but you can move a lot faster by doing that because you can use things, for example, if you build 10 products inside of one like ours, you can build one component in one product and then you can use it across every single product. So if you do it right from a development perspective, trying to use the same data models, trying to use a component that can be reused elsewhere and can be placed anywhere else inside of the product, you benefit a lot on the development leverage that you get. You can move really, really fast and iterate on these products. And that's what we do. We'll ship something that's 20% of what we want to ship. Right. And most companies would be like, that's ridiculous. You shouldn't go ship that. Huh. And sometimes I felt, we probably shouldn't ship that. But we still shipped it anyway. And you learn from it. And we listen to our community. And the community tells us exactly how they're feeling about it. And they give you ideas. And I was and still am in the community every single day reading feedback from
you're
our
still in the community
still
every
in
day
the community
reading feedback.
Every single day.
Yeah. See, I think that goes back to self-awareness, man. Like you are a product visionary. You really are. You're exceptional. And you found a way to get back even at 4 billion with a ton of employees where you're spending 70, 80% of your time on product. Like you got to know what is your N of one trait? Like what are you the best at and figure out how to stay there? Cause like, I think a big part of ClickUp's massive success is your genius and you staying in that pocket. Cause as soon as you got out of product, things didn't go the same, right? But when you're in that seat, magic happens.
And it's hard to, especially as a founder, you kind of, when a founder CEO, you feel like you need to do everything in the business, right? And you feel like you really need to focus your time on the business stuff, the operational side, the finance side, the sales, revenue. And I now have a really happy balance between all of those, but we also have really great people. Our COO is incredible, Gaurav, our CFO, Dan, she's amazing.
She's great.
And of course, Alex has stepped up and leading all of our engineering. And so it's like, we've got all of these really great people around me now. And I've been self-aware that I need to focus my time on product.
Yes.
And so I'm back to doing that, but it's also, it makes me happier. Yeah. It makes the team happier. And we get way more done by doing that. You got to really spend the time on the stuff that you enjoy, assuming that's the stuff you're also exceptional at, that you can't delegate to anyone else.
That's a great point. Throughout the last, what's been 6-7 years almost now since you started ClickUp, throughout that whole lifespan, what would you say your highest high has been in that journey? And then what was like the lowest low, darkest moment?
You know, every fundraising event was certainly one of the highs.
Yeah.
Right. It's a great, that's something I probably discounted before we raised funds, was how exciting it is for the company.
Yeah. I remember when you raised your Series A, we're at dinner celebrating. It was an amazing night.
Yeah. And it kind of rallies everyone together in a way that I just haven't, you know, seen happen before, especially our Series A. It kind of gives you that like legitimacy.
Yeah. People believe in us.
You know? Yeah. People believe in us.
People see what we're seeing.
Yeah. We're not crazy.
Yeah.
Maybe we're crazy.
We're not crazy.
Still crazy. But I think that Series A probably was that highest high because it had the validation there. I was just much more confident. I think you have this imposter syndrome that happens a lot, especially when you're kind of like an outsider, you know, where you don't go to the Ivy League schools and grow up in the venture environment or in, you know, Silicon Valley. And you feel like an outsider, right? You come into and you're like, am I even supposed to be here? I don't know what I'm doing. But the reality is everyone doesn't know what they're doing. Everybody's just figuring out as you go. You know, I talked to some of the best entrepreneurs like Richard Branson, right? And he's very much self-aware of this. Like you're just figuring it out as you go. And once I learned that piece, it really like triggered amazing results for the company. On the low side, I self-funded the company at first. We couldn't take venture capital. So I used all of the money that I made from my previous business. I got an overdraft notification because I'm not the finance person, you know, so I'm not like monitoring all the stuff I should be from a finance perspective. And I got an overdraft notification. I was like, fuck. And I still had like $100,000 in a different bank account. But the business account was out of money. And I didn't tell any of our team, you know, that I wasn't going to be able to like pay payroll after like another 2 months or so.
Wow.
So that I transferred another $50,000. And then I focused on how do we get people to pay for this thing? And I did what I learned from my previous marketing company, which was we run a lot of promotions. And especially in SaaS, I don't think I've ever seen before ours, people like running, we run like a Mother's Day promotion. We run Halloween promotions. We run
help your mom Christmas save time.
we give a discount code for every holiday that there is. Right? And so I started running, I think it was a Halloween promotion was the time. Yeah. I ran it like a few weeks early, but it was like, you know, 30% off. We do like buy one, get one free seats, BOGO seats. Oh, and after like 2 months, we were cash flow positive.
Incredible.
And,
just figuring shit out as you went.
Yeah.
That's incredible, man. Now, as sitting where you are today, like you're a different man than the guy I met 4.5 years ago. Obviously, still the same traits and like, but what I love about you, dude, is you're like the rebel. You're like the anti-Silicon Valley founder. You're like, you're not the Ivy League guy. You're like, no, I'm a hacker. I'm just like a rebel with my own points of view. I don't want to conform to the system. I just want to go do things my way and like listen to my compass. And like, you're kind of like, you're the founder people can really relate to because like you came up, you had imposter syndrome, like you didn't come from a traditional background, but you had to grow a lot to be in this seat and be effective now today. When you reflect back, like how do you think you've changed? In what ways have you had to adapt and evolve to be where you're at today?
So the 1% per day thing.
1% per
day. 1% per day is what you have to focus on. How do I grow in just a little bit more today? And that shit compounds over time. And you become a 10x person by doing that. I think that's the single only way to really like hyper grow yourself. Of course, it has to be on the right things, right? You got to be carefully choose those 1% things.
Like, how do you want to grow? In what ways? Because you could read biotechnology books every day and get 1% better at biotech, but if you're not in bio, what's the point?
Right.
So what did 1% every day look like for you? Was it reading books?
Early on, it was before we had a business and like a product there, it was reading. It was just consuming everything that I could from all of the classic Silicon Valley books. But I also was learning how to do product and learning how to do design at the same time. So a lot of my actual work was contributing to my growth. Mm. And so whenever I'm working on something, I go try and find what are the best people that have done this thing before, study them a little bit, read some of their materials, because usually they'll have, you know, a podcast or they'll have something out. I think you can learn a lot just by doing that, like hacking that shit on what you're focused on at any given time. And that's largely still what I do today. I've learned a lot about AI, and I learned just by consuming, right? Mm-hmm. By consuming and talking to people and asking questions. And I think that's like the best way to learn, as long as you're doing it also.
That's a great point.
There's too many people that like they consume, and they don't do. I think you need to be doing it at the same time. Otherwise, you just like have so much in your head of all this like knowledge and stuff, but where does it go, right? And where does it end? You can keep consuming your whole life. So I think it's really important to consume the right things at the time that you're doing them. And that's a huge way to grow.
That is the truth bomb of the century. It's when you're consuming knowledge, you haven't necessarily learned. There's an illusion of learning.
Yeah.
Learning happens when you apply something and get a result. If you can produce evidence that you got a result in life, that means you truly understand and have learned from it. Until then, it's just knowledge. But we live in this information age where we have a deficit in application. People have all the information at their fingertips, but they don't know how to apply it.
Bingo.
That's it.
Bingo.
It's so powerful, man.
We've also still do this at one of our biggest core values is grow 1% every day. So we have channels and forums where people in our company talk about what they grew on that day. And that shared knowledge helps a lot, because sometimes it's the best things that I consume a lot are what people send to me now. You know, like I especially trust a lot of people, and if I get something from them sent to me, I'm going to consume it.
Absolutely.
But yeah, that's the most critical piece about it is like, I snooze a lot of things. So I'll get a lot of like, hey, this looks cool, but I actually would just snooze it for like a year or 6 months.
And it'll pop and back click up and remind you.
Yeah. And it pops back up later. I'm like, I'm not ready for this right now. I'm not going to be able to apply it to what I'm doing in my daily life. So I'm going to snooze this to later and come back to it.
I love that, man. If we were to pivot and talk more about like the fundamentals of how you built this success, we've talked about this a lot, but I think it's the habits, right? It's the 1% things. Whatever you do compounds. When you look back, what do you think were the key habits that you attribute most of your success to?
I mean, it starts with discipline. And discipline, the biggest thing is just working your ass off and focusing on the right things. And but for me, I have to do my rituals every single day. I have to wake up at the similar time. I do a cold plunge. I do all the classic Silicon Valley things, you know, like that. And you know, by the way, like this, it's funny how like Silicon Valley was built on outsiders. You know, they were by definition many outsiders, and the best people of our generation, the Jobs, the Elons, they're all outsiders, right? And so Silicon Valley does embrace the outsiders to some extent, but there's also this kind of inside thing that's happened there. And I think it's more of like that venture world. That's more of the more of the insiders thing. And so I think we're definitely an outsider, but I love building a business that way. And fundamentally, that's how I grow also. And so I do the cold plunge. I do the 8 sleep thing we just talked about.
Maximize your sleep. Actually, 8 sleep. Shout out Mateo, incredible product.
I'm actually a believer in it. I go to sleep cold and I turn it on really hot. When I get up, I sleep about 6 hours. I go to sleep at midnight, wake up at 6.
You used to sleep 4 hours.
I used to sleep
night.
4 hours. That does not scale.
Just not scale.
Did not scale at all. In fact, I'm like 6.5 sometimes now, just like based on how I feel.
Yeah.
But yeah, for me, my 4 hours too was I have narcolepsy. Mm-hmm. My whole life had slept like 12 hours a day. I was always tired of chronic fatigue. And when I started sleeping 4 hours, I actually went to a Tony Robbins event where he said he did that. And I was like, fuck it, I'm going to try it. And it was really tough. But when I woke up, I didn't feel rested by any means, but I felt marginally more tired than I did if I've slept 12 hours. So, you know, like, might as well just do this. And I did it for that year, for that whole year of that intense period of starting ClickUp. I did it for that entire year and I slept 4 hours. But it's definitely not scalable. I can't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm six and a half now.
So you get great sleep, just working hard, cultivating the habit of discipline, because you do work harder than, I want to say close, maybe 100% of people I know, but like you're like at the top echelon, which is why I respect you so much. But I think also one thing I've noticed with you is you're extremely self-aware and reflective. I think a lot of people are do, but they don't take time to reflect. And when we talk about getting 1% better, it's action plus reflection that creates wisdom, right? And talk to me about your journaling practices and your reviews at the end of the year. I think this is so brilliant.
I've been journaling now 11 years. So I've got like 60 or 70 journals. And at the end of every year, I go to Bahamas by myself and I reread all of the journals. And for me, I just have to be totally disconnected from everybody. That doesn't mean I'm not working. I actually still am working, but I'm doing way more time on reading.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking to people. I don't do meetings at all. And so you can become very introspective. I think that's really, really important. It's like, I can go async on things, mm-hmm. but I shouldn't talk to people for that whole week. So I can be super introspective. And I learned so much from going back and rereading journals. It's like the only way to go back and feel what you were thinking at the time. And so I can go back 10 years ago, and at any time I can go back 10 years ago. And it's really incredible for, I think, having gratitude and for keeping yourself like present. Mm. But I think that the biggest thing for me is also keeping yourself kind of grounded, mm. where you can go back 10 years ago and see, like, you know, hey, I was talking about, you know, not being able to afford food and shit for a while. Like, it's very, very different problems that you're aware of. Right. And so like, I totally forget about that nowadays. So going back in time and seeing that and thinking that and living through it again, you can kind of like relive your life experiences.
Yeah.
And so I learned so much, as most people do, that you forget, even lessons that you go through that you totally forget. Mm-hmm. So I can go back, especially the most recent few years. And, you know, many of those lessons that we talked about, I actually wasn't introspective enough to just think of that on my own. I had to go back and reread my journals a few times mm-hmm. to really figure out like what went wrong. And I don't know if I would have been able to do that without my journals.
It's so powerful, man. I've been doing the same thing, journaling, I don't know, probably the last 8 years, but just to go back and reflect, you're right. I think when you're so ambitious, you're always thinking about the future. You're very rarely here in the now, which is why you reread The Power of Now all the time.
Yep.
And I totally ascribe to that. And it's so hard to constantly be driving towards a vision and then be grateful for what you have. It's very hard, especially when you have so much pressure mm-hmm. and shareholders you got to impress and, you know, you got all these things you got to do. I think it's really, really challenging. And so that's kind of your practice to get back, get rooted. Cause at the end of the day, it's like 5 years ago, where you are now is what you dreamed of. Like this was your ultimate dream. And so you're building the next dream, but like you already achieved 28-year-old Zeb's dreams. And so it's good to remind yourself of like, wow, like this is special. Take it in. There's nowhere I really have to get to. Like I've got to like enjoy the journey more.
The goalpost always moves. And when I realized, I tried to separate, and I do today, happiness from satisfaction, because I've never known what it feels like to feel satisfied. And I always like the voice in my head, I'm always like, you should feel satisfied. You should feel satisfied. You should feel satisfied. And I don't know what it feels like. And so I was trying to teach myself to be satisfied, you know? And finally I was like, fuck that. Like, I don't need to be satisfied. I need to be happy. I don't need to be happy all the time, but you need to have joy. Right? Joy when you wake up, appreciation for life, appreciation mm-hmm. for the people around you, appreciation for wherever you're at in life. And as long as you have that, I think you can go through the entrepreneur journey much easier and not as head in the clouds. You know, I think you can still like be there, be more present, be more aware if you can still constantly chase and constantly move the goalpost and be okay with not feeling satisfied, but find happiness. And it's easier said than done.
Yeah,
for sure.
How do you cultivate that joy?
I think it starts with gratitude. I really think it starts with gratitude. And I have to go back and just constantly remind myself of things. And that's what I do for like 5 minutes in the morning. I just go back and like go back in time and go through events and like, I'm grateful for this, grateful for this, grateful for this. It's almost like it's kind of insanity, you know, when you're like telling yourself things in your mind and you're like, hey, go, you know, be grateful for this, be grateful for this. But it works, I think. I think it really does. Yeah. It makes you focus on that.
Yeah.
And it reminds you of it as soon as, you know, as soon as you wake up.
Yeah.
And I also think though that I didn't have a lot of joy until I love working with the people that I work with. The people around me now are incredible people that care so much and are so passionate and have fun. You know, we joke with each other. We prank each other. You have to have a really fun work environment. I think we lost that for a little bit.
Got a little serious.
It got a little too serious.
Yeah.
And so you got to really enjoy the people you're working with because it's tough.
I love that, man. I think this mindfulness journey, because you've been on it for a while, like you've realized that you've accomplished so much in the material world. You know, you've made great money. You've built an incredible company. You're going to keep being more successful, but you quickly realized you're like, oh shit, this isn't it, right? There's something inside of me I have to focus on. Can you share a bit more about your mindfulness, your spiritual journey, like what you've learned maybe from Eckhart Tolle and some of the people that you've studied? Like, what has that process been like for you?
Have you read The Surrender Experiment?
I love that book. Michael Singer is incredible.
My favorite books. It was nuts because I actually nobody told me about that book, but you know he ended up being a tech entrepreneur,
yeah, right?
Which is like and insane.
He was like a hippie turned tech entrepreneur. He wasn't like an entrepreneur. He accidentally like built this software and was this hippie in the woods for like 15 years, and then built a $1 billion company.
And then they tried to put him in prison, right? And his whole team, and I think he got convicted, but the judge overturned it.
Yes.
He got convicted by a jury. Anyway, that book taught me a lot about just like surrendering. It's just being, you can't control everything. And so you can control a lot, to be clear. I think too many people that say you can't control everything, they don't control enough. I think you really have to be in control of a lot of things, especially in business. You can be pretty much in control of I'd say 98% of what happens in business. But for that couple percentage things that you can't control, you can't think about it. You can't worry about it. You can't figure out what's going to happen next week ahead of time. It's just not going to happen. Just let it go and enjoy the journey and know that there's going to be a lot of problems. And the problem you just dealt with, you're going to have a problem 10 times larger in the future. Mm-hmm. And that's it happens to me every single time. And so when that problem comes, I don't see it as like a bad thing anymore. And I think that those books, including Power of Now, really helped me realize that. Like you've got to stay present and not time travel. And I think entrepreneurs, they think too much about the future and probably analyze the past too much. Also, what would you do differently? And I think it is important to think about the future for sure. But it can be a detriment sometimes thinking too much about the future and not just focusing on today.
That's a freaking great point. I feel like I came to this point where I'm like, if you can learn to accept all potential outcomes, you create no resistance between you and the outcomes, you have the freedom to exist in your full power now. Like, okay, maybe this shit will break. Maybe you will lose this client. Maybe that person will break your heart. Maybe all these things will happen. Well, can you accept those outcomes as possibilities? And the moment you can accept them, you can detach from the consequences and stop living in the future and anxiety. Like, you know what? I'm just going to be here, show up the best I can now, and the rest will take care of itself, but I'm going to control my controllables.
The only real problems are health problems. And I think that's really critical to learn for me because I've had near-death experiences before.
Yeah.
And so that one resonates with me the most. That's what I always tell myself is the only real problems are health problems. And so to your point, you can, you know, if you're going through some really bad problem right now, and if you just accept the worst actual outcome that happens and you're still alive, it's all good. Right. The only real problems are health problems.
I'm curious too, because I know you've studied a lot of the greats and you've taken a lot of inspiration from virtual mentors, from dead mentors, from now you've got incredible live mentors that are some of the most accomplished people in the world. But for you, who are the entrepreneurs that you've drawn the most inspiration from that have really like influenced who you are as a person?
Richard Branson's been a huge part, and I was been fortunate enough to meet him. He's the guy that I think figured life out in many ways and has the happiness, like very, very happy, joyful. He created the environment around him in the literal way and the intangible ways. And so, yeah, I greatly respect that. It's like he got that balance of like happiness, you know, great family, but also built amazing impact and did it in different industries too, which is really difficult to do stuff in different mm-hmm. industries, right? Building tech and non-tech and building like commercial goods and retail. Like it's always very, very difficult. So I greatly respect him for that. Mm-hmm. Of course, Elon, you know, Elon is the OG, and I have an amazing amount of respect for he's so intense and just truly cares about his mission and about being net positive. Mm. Right? Very much about being net positive. And he gets a lot of shit from a lot of people. And most of those people on the other side of their mouths are talking about how they're going to make the world better and things like that without seeing how he's making the world better every fucking day. And I think that he'll go down as one of the best that's ever lived.
I see a lot of traces in those guys in you, actually. I feel like initially when you started ClickUp, you were more Steve Jobs-esque because you were so intense, so disciplined, like all the time. And then as you got, you know, as you scaled and became more mature, I feel like you stepped more into your Branson phase.
Yeah.
You became just like, you know what? I'm just going to bring a bit more joy. I'm going to be a little bit less serious. I'm still going to hold a really high standard for the work. But you've always had like that altruistic mission in your heart. Like you've always had like a good spot in your heart, but I think you just matured into a different leadership style over time.
I did. And that's exactly what happened actually in hindsight. I just learned something new. And you know, I think the net positive thing, we do random acts of kindness. And so it's been mm-hmm. our culture since day one.
Yeah.
It's been one of our core values, and it's great to, we don't tell people about it. We don't advertise this shit, but we do internal racks and external racks. And so when employees are going through tough times or they have friends or family members going through tough times, the company helps them do random acts of kindness. Or if they have a random act of kindness that they want to do, they're welcome to go do that. And then we do external random acts of kindness too. Like we used to use Craigslist. We'd put free Super Bowl tickets on Craigslist. And then we get emails and say, hey, why do you want to go to the Super Bowl? And then this is when we were a small company, like 10 or 15 employees. And then we'd put it up on a TV and everyone would go through all of the emails that we got and we would choose the 10 together. And so doing like things like that, especially as a small startup, I think it's really important because it brings people together. It also focuses them from the early times on how do you be net positive. And you can feel good about what you're building and what you're doing because the value from that goes to create more good. I think that's really important.
And that scaled. You know,
yeah.
Like you doing that so early built this beautiful culture you have today. And if you hadn't done that, it looked different, I think.
100% would look different. And Scott, founder of Atlassian, I actually chatted with him recently about this Pledge 1% initiative that he built. And I wasn't as aware of it, honestly, until I chatted with him and looked into it. And it's like, it's an amazing mission to give back, you know, 1%. Of compounding growth that happens in the business in the form of equity or in the form of revenue or whatever, in the form of time. But I think it's also important to not give just to give. Mm. And I think so many charities and NGOs are very inefficient and arguably barely net positive. So I think it's really critical to know where, if you're giving money, if you're going to a charity, that's why we don't do charities. We do random acts of kindness directly to people. Mm. We make some exceptions for certain charities for sure. But outside of that, it's like, how do you go direct to people and help the people that you're trying to help? And there's been a whole industry created out of charities. And so it's not like they're all bad by any means. There's many amazing, incredible, life-changing charities that are changing the world in so many ways. But there is a lot of bloat and there is a lot of inefficiency in that way that whole system works.
I could not agree more, man. Before I ask my last question, where can our listeners find you, engage with you online?
LinkedIn. I don't post as much as I used to. I need to start doing Zeb Talks again. I used to do.
Yes, you do.
I used to do these couple minute talks every week.
Yeah.
And then actually it was that period of rough times where I stopped doing it. Yeah. I was like, I can't fake it right now. I don't want to talk to everyone. But I should start doing that again. So yeah, so LinkedIn, Instagram at DJ Curfew, email zeb@clickup.com.
I love it. All right, DJ Curfew too. We didn't get a chance to dive into his DJ career. That'll be for episode two. But dude, you're an amazing entrepreneur. You're a former DJ. You're a great friend. I mean, you're so accomplished. But I'm curious, when you look at the big picture of your life, at the end of your life, what do you really want to be remembered for?
I don't know if I should say this one, but I want to create a third political party. I want to create a new political party. And I've been wanting to do that for a long time. I think it's the right time.
Well, dude, I'm excited for your future. And I just want to say, man, like, you have brought so much inspiration to me. I think you're just so fully yourself and so powerful in following your own vision and compass. And no matter what the world has said, people have doubted the shit out of you throughout this whole journey. People have cast stones. You just have stayed true to yourself, and you've built such an incredible company. And just to be able to be a tiny part of it and experience that with you, like I said, it's just been ridiculously fulfilling, man. And I look to you for inspiration. I really take what you say to heart, and I aspire to live at the standard of excellence and commitment to craft that you exhibit. And I know people are just going to get tons from this.
I greatly appreciate that. And I've actually take a lot of inspiration from you. And I think that's the best friends that you can have, or people that inspire you, right? People that like enable you to dream bigger and keep going, but that also have been through those hard things together. And you can share those stories and those learnings. And you know, we came up at like the same time. It was amazing to see your growth as well. And I greatly appreciate you. And this was awesome.
Awesome, brother. Hey guys, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the World Class Podcast. Don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe across all our platforms. Hit that notification bell so you can get updates on our new episodes. And we'll see you next week.